And I'm going to call this meeting of the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission to order for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. At IU Northwest to order. Please set your phones on stun and let's stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. Flag to my right.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Lambert, roll call, please.
Here.
Present.
Here.
Present.
Here.
Ron Ware.
Here.
Present.
Present. We have a quorum. Next up is the approval of the minutes from May 17th, 2023. Modifications, changes, motions. What say you?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve the minutes from May 17th, 2023.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Mr. Wicklund, are we still on roll call?
We are.
Oh, goodness. When is that going to end? Please work on that for me. Mrs. Lambert?
Yes.
Yes.
Anthony Brodnick?
Abstain.
Yes.
Dave
Castellanos?
Yes.
Ron Ware?
Yes.
Robert Oakley?
Yes.
Yes.
William Baker?
Yes. Next up is the chairman's report. My name is Bill Baker. I'm the chairman. I've been the chairman since 2010. What happens if you don't take care of a $275 million man-made flood control project are on those aging pictures over here from September 2008. When those things happen, it affects the entire community. We are far better prepared we are today than we were prior to that event in 2008. This is truly an economic development project because we work with each community within the watershed to make sure that doesn't happen again. But keep in mind, we're managing Mother Nature. And at the end of the day, she's going to win when we get 10 gallons of water for our 5-gallon bucket. So let's focus on the fact that we're trying to do improvements to what's been done $275 million ago. As we continue to spend moving forward, we're going to take care of the entire watershed because this is an environmental recreational flood control project of which we have a litany of things that have happened that are positive and continue to move forward, including having the opportunity to remove over 1,000 property owners having to pay mandatory flood insurance, which puts at least $4 million every year back into the community every year. So enough of talking about the things that have happened in the past. Let's move forward on finance report. We need the approval of the claims from June 2023.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve the claims for June of 2023 in the amount of $1,099,235.59.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
And a second. Mr. Repay, highlights.
Quick highlights would be the tune of, let's see, $45,682.48 for Dyer Construction. They're the ones that did our sealant repair for stage 7. They happily completed it before our inspections on June 5th. And so it was done very well. We had a crack staff of Paul Daniels overseeing it and making sure that their numbers worked out, able to be, I believe, under budget on that one. So that's done. CNH Mowing, which was our mow right before the inspections, that's $27,500. Trying to decide if we want to do another one before 4th of July. There's some parts that need it, some parts that may not, so that will be a decision here in the near future. Great Lakes Electro Maintenance, they're in charge of all our pumps and inspections. We had a couple issues with some SCADAs going off in the middle of a dry season, but we were able to fix that. And we've got NCAP for $14,400, which are maintaining the Chase Street and the Black Oak mitigation site that we had just completed. The large one, of course, is City of Crown Point for $777,381.19. That's reimbursement for the Sowerman Woods Drainage Improvement Project, which should conclude as far as the digging portion of it by mid-July. Delta 3, once again, was stabilization work and the work that they did in Dyer Ditch, as well as Martin Mechanical had various pump station repairs. We just have one pump station in Burn North right now, along with the sump pump, because the parts that are needed for the impeller are on back order. And so until those get in, we cannot repair the pump so far. We've been good shape with the weather, thankfully, but we hope by mid-July that too will be completed. So other than that, I could answer some issue. We have Northern, well, you know what, I should go with Northern Indiana Mechanical. They took care of two blockages for us. One, we had to close down Clark Road completely to do it. I sent some pictures from that on my report, and as well as the Kennedy Avenue blockage, and that was 5782. We had to reduce lanes down to one lane in each direction. So I guess I'll now take questions.
All right, back to the board. Any questions for Mr. Repay about paying the bills?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Gazdecki.
Mr. Repay, can you tell me about the stencil structure ID project and when that might be finished?
They are finished. We've told Garcia and it, and the Corps had some bad information as far as their identifying of the structures. As I've said in the past, the Corps requires us to identify each structure, pump station, gate, lift station, culvert, and so they had to go out and stencil it. And then when during inspections, they said, well, this should have been five, I'm just using example five, and it should be six. So what we're going to do is, as opposed to re-stencil it, it was their error. We're just going to have them change it in the book to being the number that's the correct number. So Garcia is not going to touch another stencil as long as I'm here, I think.
And then with Garcia and the sandbar maintenance. We've had, obviously, the legislature has given us some authority we didn't have before. I know that part of that project, when we had to move the dirt from one side of the river to the other, required us to maintain and monitor invasive species.
Right. So now what he did was he gave me the plans. We're in the process of getting the soil tested. And so when the time is right to file the proper permits with the Army Corps, we'll have all the information that we need. The plans are pretty much how we want them. We're going to adjust them a little bit, because in the past there were some agencies that wanted us to pull the material out, and then there's some material wanted to keep it in, and we're going to try to do sort of both, leave it in and improve the banks where we should and can, take it out where it doesn't make sense, and put it in a location that's, you know, that's required for this type of material.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Going once, going twice. We have a motion and a second. Mrs. Lambert.
Yes.
Yes.
Anthony Brodnick.
Yes.
Derek Minnick.
Yes.
Dave Castellanos.
Yes.
Ron Ware.
Yes.
Robert Bochy.
Yes.
LaVon Whitaker.
Yes.
Ian Baker.
Yes. Moving right along, Mr. Repay, Executive Director's Report, Project Tracker. What's going on in the field?
Well, number one was inspections. We finished off all the inspections except for the Katie Marsh ditch, which will happen at the end of July. That's just a small portion. But the inspections for Hammond, Highland, and Munster have all been completed. Derek got to join us on the Highland one. Only one issue that of note was a gate that was stuck in the down position by the BMV. In Hammond, we are having a contractor fix that. We don't understand why it keeps on locking up in the down position. But for our sake, it's better to be stuck in the down position than the up, because it prevents backflow. So we're going to use these inspections as sort of our work order going forward and fixing the small issues that do still persist, whether it's additional caulking in some areas or not. But for the most part, there were no large issues that we were made aware of by the Corps. And usually they give us a report, just a briefing after every day, and nothing of major consequence was brought to our attention, meaning no pump stations weren't working, no gates didn't function the way they should have, and no city or community didn't have the stuff or material that they knew. The new drills that were purchased, the two new drills, they're battery powered, were received very well. They were very successful. One of the downfalls was that it went through more battery than they were anticipating. So we may look to add some batteries to that, but Hammond, Highland, and Munster all liked what they did, and the Corps was approved of how it went as well. So that's a plus. As I mentioned, stage 7 caulking was complete. we have completed that, which was important as far as the way that that was constructed in stage seven. The caulking was a part of the defense for the levee, so that was an important flood control aspect. On a slightly different matter, Maya was in default. They did not make their payment by the June 1st, and our attorney sent out a letter notifying them of their default. And if my math is correct, they have until August 31st of this year to remedy that. And if they don't, then we'll have to take the next steps. We're also doing work with Hart Ditch, clearing some of the dead and dying trees in the areas between 45th and Fran Lynn. As I mentioned, we did some bridge clearing both at Clark, Kennedy, and we also did a railroad bridge off of Kennedy as well.
That's under the bridge, right?
Under the bridges. Okay. And the problem is partially is since there's so low flow that there's nothing's moving through and it gets stuck on a sandbar and then it just sort of snowballs. I wish there was snow, but there was just keeps on increasing problems for us. We still have negotiations with NDOT regarding their pump stations, both on Kennedy Avenue and Indianapolis Boulevard. NDOT isn't really well equipped to handle pump stations. We've asked them that we would take it over and manage them because they are a part, you know, of the entire system. As far as we're going to get the phone call, as you say, Mr. Chairman, when that red light is beeping and no one else is around.
And the Borman floods.
They're and the Borman floods. NDOT. Right. And so I spoke briefly about the Burr Street pumps. We did the levee mowing. Sowerman Woods is going along. There's a pedestrian bridge ribbon cutting for the city of Hammond on the 29th, which is next Thursday at 3:30. So I'm expecting the chairman to have a grand speech. So they're anticipating that. And then a new thing that happened before I gave you my report, but something that has occurred, we are going to do, we have reached out to Superior Engineering and got a hold of those folks to do a pump station assessment on all the Gary pump stations. So the reason why is we've added those sump pumps, we've added additional pumps, and they still aren't functioning as to what we think they should. According to Glem, myself, they just are overworking themselves. And I think by doing this assessment through Superior, they may be able to offer us some better ideas and technology. Those stations are over 20 plus years old and may need a new PLC. So they'll be able to tell us that. And so hopefully in the coming months, I'll be able to report back to you what their findings are. So that was something that was new that developed in the time that I sent this out on Friday until today. Our O&M meeting went great today. We had Highland, Munster, Hammond, Griffith. Who else was there? I think that's all we had there, but we all talked about the inspections, about the drills, about what was to happen. And even though we are in a drought, it still doesn't take very much for us to be back into a non-drought situation. So we have those every month and we talk about what ifs and our capabilities. So with that, I will turn it over to you.
All right. Couple of questions. Mm-hmm. One, thank you for the shot on the ribbon cutting. Not a fan of those. Are they going to have the panels up?
I don't know.
All right, please check to see if that in fact is going to happen. With regards to the caulking on the levee and stage seven, the initial work only lasted 8 years. Is there any guarantee from this particular work that we're going to get a little bit more traction on that caulking? And are we going to assume that's going to be in stage eight as well?
Well, stage seven was different because the way that was designed, and it was constructed by a separate company as well, believe it or not, for the efficiencies, that those panels were actually a part of the flood control. Whereas in stage eight, those panels are more decorative. So stage seven, those crowns and those caps that you see on it with as long with the rivets along through the panels were all a part of the flood protection. When you get to stage eight, those crowns are just decorative. That's in addition to the flood protection we need. I can tell you with having Paul out there vigilantly watching them, he would probably tell you, and we saw it the same, is that the contractor that did it didn't do it properly. They didn't put any backing in. They just filled it all with caulk and eventually it just gave way. So the periodically we do handle caulking in different stages. And we've done it, but we've never gone that far to the west because those are the newer sections. So to answer your question, we may have to do stage 8 eventually, but it's not as critical as stage 7 because that was flood protection.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Repay? What's going on in the field?
Dan, we cleared the debris at Kennedy, and then we went east towards the railroad trestle off of Clark.
Did we clear that, or did the railroad clear that?
Are you talking about the one off of Burr, the railroad at Burr?
East between Clark and Calhoun, there's a railroad trestle
there. Yeah, that's by Burr. That would have been the railroad. We generally don't like to touch railroads. The only one we do touch is or get near is the one that used to be the old, what is it, north-south that runs by the armory. It's now CN, but we do that one. The Burr one, we do not touch. We let the railroad touch that. They have a machine that comes and picks it up off the railroad tracks.
So do they do that on all the crossings? I mean, does each of the railroads that have crossings over the Little Cow have that device to perform that service?
I don't know if all of them have it.
So like, for example, what about the one in Hammond by the Oxbow Lake between the Boulevard and Kennedy Avenue?
That's the one we do. We have easy because we have easy access to it. The one on Burr Street is not easy accessible for us. And we're afraid of putting the amphibious one in there because if in case it drifts and it hits a railroad.
So what about the old Monon, now new Nickty, Hammond to Munster?
If you remember about 6 years ago, we removed all the piers in that. So there should not be any piers that get caught with blockages in that area.
And if I recall correctly, since they're starting that and they're moving down the line, that they're not putting anything else in the river as a part of the new bridge design for the Nickty extension.
It's not in the channel, but it's technically within our level of protection. It's up on a bank. So what you'll see is our levee, their pier, water, natural flow water, their pier again, our wall. So it's not in the main channel. Under high flow conditions, there could be things that could hit their piers, but it's not going to be at a point where Kennedy Avenue has 6 piers in the water. So it just catches everything. Right. It's like a fly trap.
Thank you. Anybody else for Mr. Repay?
One other question. Dan, where do we stand with NIPSCO finishing up on the work at your spring park?
It's actually not, NIPSCO's got the order to do it. They've put their request in for power over the railroad tracks that run east and west through that area. Because you can't run, you have to get their permission to run power over a rail line. So whether it's, we're waiting on the railroad to allow us to put the power, additional power over their lines. It's not NIPSCO. I wish we could maybe enter in a contract with railroad companies to get our permits done faster.
Hopefully by the end of the year.
Dan, the going back to the pump stations. So Superior is examining the sumps or the entire station because we don't have an issue with capacity of the pumps.
No, I think they're gonna look at the PLCs to make sure that it's turning on, because what we've done or what you guys have done is allowed us to put additional sump pumps that had not been working. And what's happening now is we're putting them in and they're running constantly, like all the time. And we're trying to increase the floats and it still isn't working. We've increased it to the highest level that we're allowed to on our system. So it may require new PLCs to help alleviate that. Like the one we put at Grant West, it is running nonstop. And that well is 15, 20 feet deep. We have capacity.
Yeah, only the sumps are running nonstop.
Correct.
The main pumps are not necessary.
Right. But if they keep on running that way, what we do is we get low well warnings, and then it's going to burn it out.
So why are we not running the main pump?
Well, we did do that when we didn't have the sump pumps, but I'd rather run a sump pump dry because those larger pumps are $80,000 a piece. So what's happening is they're kicking on so hard that they're like, you know, they're getting themselves ready and they work for 2 seconds and then they're shut down. And that's what caused the Burr Street one to sort of have the issues that it's having with its rings and the impeller and all that stuff, is that it's been kicking on so much for pump one that it's causing it to wear out faster than what it should. So they're looking at the PLC to make sure that the system is all working the way it should. Like I said, those things are 25 years old. They're going to give us a look there, is tell us an assessment, see if it's functioning, if it's something we should improve upon or something that we can change. Glenn said we needed someone to look out there. I agreed. We're getting alarms that we shouldn't be getting.
Okay. All right. The last thing, NCAP. NCAP's out of DeKalb, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did anybody else locally bid on that, or did we bid this out?
No, NCAP was the actual group that did the work out there, the mitigation work out there at Black Oak and in Chase Street. So we asked them for a proposal. I believe we went through our resident expert as far as what the price was and whether it was fair and reasonable, because they've got to do, you know, spot spraying, control burns, whatever it takes to be able to control that area that we just spent $750,000 on. So we just asked NCAP because they were the most
knowledgeable
and they would have been on the ground right there. So I wouldn't have to re-educate anybody.
Okay. Do they have minority participation? Are you aware?
I don't know. I only deal with one guy out there, so I don't know who they have as far as employees.
Okay. Is the roughly $88,000 contract, do we require that they have minority participation as part of their contract? Or do we know?
I don't know what in the agreement or in our resolution, if there is a ground level or not.
Is that something that we should? I mean, that's something that we should require? Do we care?
We do care, but if you require it, they can't meet it, then what happens? And we can't find anybody to do the work.
I think procedurally, what we should have is something that says we couldn't. We had that first.
So go through the process and then at least have it of record that we tried. Is that the premise?
Yeah. Do we have anything on record that says that what they did and couldn't fulfill?
So what kind? This is a service agreement, right?
If we care.
It is. It's just making sure that the items and things that they spent 5 years producing and cultivating doesn't go back to an invasive species.
But this is on every agreement that we do. So we're back to the same not conversation. It is.
Yeah, not limited to this one. You're right.
On every contract. And I don't think,
we pay contractors pretty good for them to tell us, I would think that they should be able to tell us, hey, these are the things we did, and this is what we were not able to, and these are the reasons why. I think we pay them pretty good money to be able to just give them some communication. And at one point in time, we were trying to say, we were gathering a list of if you knew somebody that was a minority contractors, all right, here's a database that we have that says, did you try these guys? And so why can't we give those guys that so that
database, Dan, we've had this conversation.
I'm going to put Derek on the spot. I mean, and I'm sorry, because this is what you do for a living. I don't know. I mean, this is pretty specialized stuff. Not saying that there isn't any companies that have specialized stuff, but the reason why it was NCAP was because of how the Army Corps designed this mitigation area and how they had to do it in light of the fact that you're also working around the Eagle's Nest, which requires a whole another boatload of permits. So
that was something.
I don't want to make assumptions. I mean, the reality is we could just ask them.
Yeah.
Because they are somewhat of a larger company. They're not, they are local within the Chicagoland region. There aren't many vendors that do restoration and herbicide applications, although we have some that are in the audience today, for hire in our area. So I would think that we should just ask them.
I have no problem asking. I just don't know.
Because we're making some assumptions that they're not meeting. And I don't know if that's the case.
I can ask.
Yep.
Yeah, that's all I'm asking. Not limited to them, but you know, wherever we contract with that, it should be a requirement for us.
Anyway, by law, by Indiana law, if any contract goes over $50,000, it should be, especially from a government agency, it should it's supposed to have minority participation. At least it's supposed to be in any contract that you send out. And if the contractor does send back his price, we should be able to say that he solicited minority contractors to participate. And if he can show evidence that they didn't, or they said they denied, then therefore the contract can go forward. But by law, they're supposed to be able to go ahead and allow these major contractors put in their contract that they're supposed to be up and to show that they definitely try to reach minority contractors. That's it.
Dan, let's come up with a form for that particular subject matter. So with everybody that we do business with, they could at least fill out the form. So there's some type of paperwork trail as it relates to how they handle this type of stuff, because we have this conversation consistently.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Repay on what's going on in the field? Either none. Moving right along, Mr. Repay, please introduce presentations. We have two today, folks. One's from Dr. Spencer Cartwright, and one's from the Lake County Parks. First up will be from Mr. Repay introducing said.
Well, Spencer, just to give you some brief history, and he'll give you more. The area that is located just to the north of us in the second parking lot, or the auxiliary parking lot, he has been working with. By the way, you guys can sit in the front row. We left the front row open so that you guys could see clearly. So he has started, he worked with the Gary Parks Department. We have a easement on that levee. And it started when I started, well, it started before I was here, but it started at Broadway and has progressed to Harrison. And so at that point, we had to work together with our Army Corps inspectors, because sometimes his levee's in full bloom by the time we get inspections. And I think though we've got a little system going now where he has his burns and we are able to inspect it. And quite honestly, I was actually supposed to go out to Seattle, do a presentation about different vegetation allowable on levees, and I couldn't make it. So
okay.
With all further ado, it's your show.
Well, thanks very much. And when Dan and I were trying to coordinate having this meeting here, Dan also said, "What would you like to give a little presentation on the history of what you've been doing there?" And I said, sure enough, this seems like the right time, because now there's a bit of history. And I came to IU Northwest in the fall. Spencer Cartwright from the biology department at Indiana University Northwest. And I came here in the fall of 1992. And one of the first things I heard fellow faculty members talk about was the time it rained so much that the water came almost over the parking lot north of the campus. Just heard that, just put it in the back of my mind. I was new here trying to get tenure, and all my field work was in Southern Indiana. So I wasn't going to act on that at that point, but I just put it in my mind. A few years, right around that same time, I met Sandy O'Brien, and she told me that just because a natural area is green doesn't mean it's good, that there's full of non-native plants. And I'd heard of purple loosestrife and a few others, but I had no idea it was as bad as she was telling me. So I decided, even though I was a zoologist, that I would start learning some of the vegetation of Northwest Indiana. And then a little bit later, I started to see the levee going up there. So I figured A plus B equals C. A, the parking lot almost flooded. B, a levee's going up. C, that should be reduced over time. And then after that, when the levee was getting almost done, I looked at the lay of the land outside of the levee and along the levee, and I thought, there's nothing that anybody can do with that land because it's too narrow and you can't compromise the levee. What little I knew of that kind of stuff. And so I thought, I better try to figure out if we could revegetate that in this native vegetation. And so I think I talked with Ed Karlotka, I think his name is. I might have his last name mispronounced there, but he was the core engineer on the site. And he, I think, got
meet with some other people, and we looked at some other sites along the corridor. This is sometime in the 1990s that were being revegetated. He showed me this wet woodland, which I can't quite remember where it is now, but he said a company from Atlanta was revegetating that. And I thought that was a little weird that it was from Atlanta by my memory. But I thought, what about when they leave? Is it still going to be any good? And then the area west of Colfax over by the spring that's there, that was revegetated as well. So I thought, hey, there's a little bit of momentum here. I should pick it up and carry this momentum forward. So I started learning a little bit about what restoration ecology is. I got the Gary Parks Department, the commission, and the Army Corps of Engineers together and got official permission to do the outside of the levee. So in this reverse Nike swoosh area here was what the permission was. So I, being a zoologist, I had to just start growing some plants and seeing what they looked like. So down along the southern edge, I was just growing some plants, see how fast native plants would grow, how competitive they were. And then finally decided it was time to get started. So I got a couple of hefty garbage bags of seeds from Fermilab. They have, as you may have heard, huge restorations there in Western Chicago. And I borrowed one of our campus tractors with a disking apparatus behind it. On a day like today, or a dry spell like this in June of whatever year, I just drove that around the area along Broadway there for hours on end. If I end up with COPD, it's because of the dust I breathed in that. They didn't have a COVID mask at that point. Then we finally started at the flood wall here and started spreading the seeds out, which I thought would fill the whole site, but they didn't. And as we were spreading them out, birds were eating them. So I got the chain link fence hooked up to the tractor as fast as I could and started driving it around to partially cover them up on there. Anyway, that was the early efforts on that. And then we had the mighty acorns came out and helped us throw seeds out. I hope those kids who are now adults come by occasionally and see the flowers. And so over time, we just started taking that Broadway effort and moving it west. And you know, based on what I'd read about restoration ecology, I thought this was going to be in a flash. This was going to be restored and that it would be so good that people would see all this other land here, east and west along there. And before I knew it, the whole watershed would be filled with a new nature preserve of grand stature. And that was my dream in whatever year. When I started realizing that every restoration that's not on an old farm field has its own unique problems, you figure them out, you face them, figure them out, it takes a lot longer to do that. One example I'll give you is mugwort. No one mentioned that mugwort was a bad plant to have around, and I noticed some was out there along Broadway. And one day, Sandy O'Brien drove by, and then a week later, she called me and said, "You better do something about that mugwort." And I thought to myself, this is the first person who's ever mentioned anything bad about mugwort. She's a sample of one. Now, she's a goddess of samples, but she's a sample of one. So I didn't act on it for 2 years, and now I'm paying the price still on that. So you find that each site has its own problems, and that slowed down the progress on it. So I think of Senator Douglas from Illinois, who said, "When I was a young man, I wanted to save the world. In my middle age, I wanted to save my country. And in my old age, I want to save the Indiana Dunes." So I was originally going to save the whole watershed. Then I was just going to save the area right up here in addition to the swoosh. Now it's just, I want to make the swoosh as perfect as possible. And of course, the main bloom season is starting now. And you'll see that over time. So I've been more than content to work on that. But in the recent years, the folks from Lake County, Great Lakes Audubon, the Nature Conservancy have started picking up the pace. And they're going to talk to you some about areas east and west here and what they're doing. And now I know I don't want to pass away anytime soon. But at least when it does come, that original vision will be enacted. It may take decades. But just think, there could be thousands of acres of a new nature preserve. And it could be so spectacular that people driving that Borman every day through here that normally blitz through it are going to hear what a great nature preserve this is. and they will stop and enjoy it. But I don't know how much time, if I'm over or not, but let's look at just a few pictures. These were randomly put in here, just showing little spots in it that you learn. And then this is over by the three-way stop north in the north part of Gleason Golf, what was Gleason Golf Course. That's a really eye-catching zone there. If you stop, don't blow that stop sign. Pause there for a moment. It's the bloom season will start soon. There, I mean, there have been a few already blooming periods. And there's a, anyway, you'll see. Just take a trip over there and some other areas in there. And then we finally, this is the northwest corner, which we started in 2016. I had a student working, putting in a few plants right around that telephone pole. I don't know if she remembers it, but it was a dusty weather. She probably got COPD from that too. But so that was, I know that was 2016. And then this was maybe 3 or 4 years later. So it's looking good. And there's the people that drive by and what they get to see. And around a few years ago, the Army Corps engineers mentioned that we have a new vegetation plan. I think Dan actually alerted me to this. And then I heard it, I had to start reading the new vegetation plan and make sure I understood it, and then had to write up what I was doing in much more form, because many years people let me work there. Nobody ever checked anything. But then I knew I had to be very communicative, checking and all that, the inspections that Dan mentioned. And so if you drive up on top of the levee on the nice trail there, you'll oftentimes see pulled out wheat plants there, because I want to make sure the edge doesn't erode from the blacktop trail. I don't want any erosion there. So if I see there might even be a hint of it, I try to work that area, and you'll see me pull out stuff and put new stuff in there. And the great thing about this site is there's so many different micro habitats there. It's almost like a hill prairie on the levee, which is very rare in the Chicago area. But it's not really a hill prairie because of the crowned blacktop trail. When it rains just a half an inch, that's like a 4-inch rain to the top of the hill prairie, which doesn't happen naturally. So in weather like this, it's behaving like a hill prairie, but in a wet summer, it's almost like a wetland there, which makes for very weird habitats. But there's so many different habitats. It's really fun to work in there. The wet areas, I just love working down in there. Lots of good stuff. This is over there along Broadway. And of course, the erratic water that does collect on the outside of the levee has been a great challenge. I could go into on and on, but I want to get on to the to the other guys, how you have to try to figure out what plants can handle water that might be this deep, like in 2008, other years this deep, and then not like it's been for 2 years, it hasn't been above that deep. And a lot of these are ones that can make it in some of that kind of area. Well, not this one in the wet areas. That's right along over there by the Harrison Street Bridge, and a few along Broadway. And that's that area going up to the bridge. That's so nice. That White False Indigo must be one of the biggest ones there ever was. And in the wet areas, a little bit too much of this wild hibiscus down there. Kind of miscalculated on that one. See it. It grows pretty crazy. And then they like to inspect it. So this year we started over by the bridge and got going along here. And let me see. This is a little video, but I'm not quite sure how I get down to the video. Oh, there it is. But how do I make the video go?
Doc, I thought that we weren't able to do burns along the foreman. How did you get approval for that?
Well, we have to go through Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and then you have to go through the city of Gary and just promote your plan and forget that. Oh, there it is. You just click it again. So we're like a mile north of the Borman here, and that amount of smoke by the time it gets to the Borman is pretty well toned out. And I think I have another picture here. So there you can see that we try to pick a day when much of the time the smoke is almost going straight vertical. And so that should help along getting out to the Borman. And there's Chris. And then now I know, click twice. So this is along Broadway, and you just try to pick a day when the smoke is not going to go on Broadway, and You can see we burned on the levee for the inspection, so even though fire looks a little bit racy there, it's going to just go over across that field and then go out. So that was a few pictures. I hope I didn't take too much time. And if anybody has any questions before we pass it off. Thanks. Any questions?
Any questions?
Yes.
How many invasive species do you think you've been able to eradicate?
Well, I wouldn't say any. I wouldn't say any are eradicated, but something like reed canary grass used to fill acres along there. And it's probably 98 to 99% eliminated, which normally you'd say, hey, that's pretty successful. But like metastatic cancer, if you knock the cancer back 98 or 98%, it's going to come back and it's going to kill you. So I don't mean to make light of that, but you got to keep looking at it. Even though a person visiting may not even see much reed canary grass, you got to have somebody still looking at it because it'll be back. There are a few that I think I've gotten rid of, but the main ones that cause problem are Candida thistle, the mugwort, the reed canary grass, Phragmites, and the hybrid cattail. Those are probably the top five. And if you looked at some of the swale along the former golf course there 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you'd have said, hey, you better get on that hybrid cattail. But if you went there now, you'd say, I think he's got it under control. So that's a short answer to a very complex set of issues that I knew nothing of when I started, just had to learn it. Any others?
All right, thank you, sir, very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Hey, what's next?
Pleasure.
Next, we have Daniel and Harry with Lake County Collaborative, which is what we've been funding now for what, 2 years? On-ish? 3 years? Well, go. I'll let them introduce all their partners because if I forget one, then I get in trouble. But what they're going to do is give you an update on the progress of what they have done in the segments that we've authorized. And then they may also, I don't know what their presentation exactly says, but they may also look into the future as to some areas that they're looking to do. So with that, it's all yours. Make sure you use the microphone.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Harry Kuttner. I'm the Calumet coordinator with the Wetlands Initiative. We're one of the partner organizations within the Little Calumet Conservation Collaborative. Other key members are the Basin Commission, City of Gary, Audubon Great Lakes, the Nature Conservancy of Indiana, Lake County, Indiana Parks and Recreation, and NIPSCO as well. But yeah, so this is our mid-year progress report. So I'll start off. I know for those of you who have seen me talk in front of you before, start off talking about contractor invasive management work. So we haven't spoken to you for about a year, I believe. So last fall, we had our annual round of contractor work, usually targeting Phragmites, which is in August and September. So we had successful rounds of treatment at each site. So at Grant Street Wetland, we treated about 32 acres of Phragmites, I believe. This is a map looking at what we've got planned for August and September of 2023. So we're working using a Marshmaster, which is an amphibious vehicle, to spray that Phragmites. So up on the screen, all that red area is the target area. Also this past winter, we cleared about 2.5 acres of invasive trees and shrubs in the southwest corner at the site. We've been working closely with Steve Barker at NIPSCO to make sure that we're in line with their restoration biodiversity plan across their corridor. And this year we're expanding onto the NIPSCO right away at the northern end of the site. What we saw in 2022 was that the Phragmites population was going way down from past years. So this photo down there, that's basically that brown area is all formerly Phragmites. That photo was taken, I think, in early July. So you can see there's little patches of green coming up in here and there. But overall, big reduction. We're still seeing big reductions in 2023. So our contractor costs are also going down as well, because the cost per acre is going down because it's retreatment rather than like the first heavy lifting and treatment. Moving over to Highland Rookery. So up here, again, the red area is the treatment area. That's across most of the site, which is what we've treated for the past 2 years. But again, it's really gonna be sort of spot treatment. And last year, they only ended up treating about a third of that area based on the phragmites that they were seeing. This year, we're expanding to include another 3.5 acres along Klein Avenue. So that's like a really visual thing. People getting off the highway see all that phragmites. So we're excited to take a crack at that. And again, yeah, seeing population reductions.
No before and after though, huh?
I did not include them this year.
Yeah, tell us, yeah.
We do have some good photos coming up. Over at MLK South Wetland. So this is where the Lake County Parks crew is doing the majority of their day-to-day work in terms of our three project areas. That's mostly because of it's the most accessible on foot. It's doesn't have a lot of open water, so they can get around across most of that southern half. So this map on the left real quick, that blue area is an aerial treatment zone. So we did a helicopter aerial application last fall. This year, we're going to be working with a drone application for the very first time, which we're really excited about. The drone gives the contractor the ability to fly a few feet above the target vegetation, which has less of a chance of drift of that herbicide, you know, which we don't want to impact the levee. We don't want to impact any of our good plants on site. And we obviously don't want to impact the surrounding community. So the drone should really reduce those chances of drift. The yellow is terrestrial herbicide, which will basically be a follow-up to the aerial herbicide. Again, we're expanding up on the NIPSCO right-of-way and the area north of the right-of-way. At this site, we're still seeing phragmites reduction. It's not as dramatic as some of our other sites. And one reason for that is that we've had droughts for the past 2 years. So the phragmites likes those drier conditions. So it's moving into some of those formerly wet areas. Lastly, at MLK South, we have a prescribed burn planned for this fall and winter. Would be maximum extent about 50 acres. So we did a burn. Here's a photo from the burn in 2021. It was really successful. It helps reduce fuel load. It helps, it triggers native seed germination, which is really good. Honestly, at this site, getting rid of that fuel load is a huge benefit. It allows our crews to get out there. It allows our contractors to get out there without all the old phragmites still standing. They can seed new areas. Following year application of herbicide will be much less herbicide needed because you're not dealing with all this standing vegetation from last year that you're fighting through. So excited to get that done this fall. Quickly to touch on the Lake County Parks crew. So I've got a photo down here at the bottom. That is a Wetlands Initiative staff member conducting a chainsaw and brush cutter training for some Lake County Parks staff. That was funded with a 2022 NIPSCO Environmental Action Grant, also paid for some new chainsaws, new safety PPE equipment for the Lake County Parks crew. Lake County Parks crew, they worked all last winter clearing it's a walking path through the woodland at MLK South, but also is really serving a dual purpose as access for contractor equipment. So getting in the edges of those woodlands is really hard unless you have an access path. We've also been doing our monthly field visits and check-ins with the Lake County Parks crew to make sure that they have their questions answered about the sites. Lots of back and forth with all our partners is really important. Some of the good stuff. So I put that plant list in there for Mr. Nimitz. But so in 2023, the Basin Commission is providing expanded funding to pay for native plugs and native seeds, which we're putting in primarily at MLK South and Highland Rookery. So we had a volunteer plug planting this May, I believe. We had about 10 students from Spencer's class and then 20 volunteers from NIPSCO, which we were really excited about. It was a great event. We got in about 2,400 plugs in like 2.5 hours, 46 different native species went in at MLK South, and then we put in 1,000 plugs at Highland Rookery the following week. Again, 46 species. And we did that with Lake County Parks crew and TNC field crews. Those plantings are only possible because of all the invasive management work that we've done. We're seeing open areas where there's the ability to put in new plantings that they're gonna have a chance of survival and to outcompete some of those invasive species. In addition to all the volunteer and crew work, Audubon has been working on securing some contractors to do another 7,000 plugs at the northern end of MLK South in the wetter areas. We're also planting with the future water control structures in mind. So what I mean by that is we'll have some water control structures in by the end of September, which will allow for higher water levels to be maintained at MLK South and Highland Rookery. So we're planting plants that can survive inundation of 1 or 2 feet, looking into, you know, the future, basically. We also will be putting in about $8,000 worth of seed this winter across Highland Rookery and MLK South in targeted areas. Yeah, and here's a photo, not as beautiful as Spencer's, of some really successful, healthy native plantings from contractor plantings that happened in 2021. Lastly, for my part, I just want to touch on the water control structures. I know we've been talking about them for a long time. So we have funding to pay for these through a National Fish and Wildlife Foundation Chi-Cal Rivers grant. That runs out at the end of this year, so we need to get them in. We've been held up for a long time with permitting, but we received a 404 and a 401 to get these structures in. The last permit that we're waiting on is a DNR Division of Water permit, but it's expected any day now. We just signed a proposal with FH Passion last Friday to do the structure construction. I know that Dan has worked with them in the past, I believe. So we'll have the Highland Rookery structure going in mid-August and the MLK South structure going in a couple weeks later. All the construction will be done in the course of 4 weeks. What I do want to point out is that that NIFWIF grant, we had $105,000 budgeted for both structures collectively. That cost estimate was based on estimates from the Army Corps of Engineers. That estimate was provided in probably 2020 or 2021 before inflation and everything started costing a lot more. So the structures are actually going to cost $175,000. So we're $70,000 over budget. We are able to pay for the structures with some leftover invasive management funds that the Basin Commission provided, in part because our contractor costs are going down because of the success of, you know, successive herbicide applications. And then the Wetlands Initiative is covering the other, I think it's about $35,000 with unrestricted funds that we have for Calumet area projects. So not excited that it's over budget, but we are really excited to get them in. It's well worth the money. And, you know, we're hoping to see dramatic changes ecologically with the installation of these structures. Hopefully this will allow for, you know, decreases in invasive management going forward, increase opportunities to do native plug plantings, all the good stuff. That's all I have to talk about. I'll pass it over to Daniel, but I don't know if there's questions about any of that for now.
With the advent of the drone, mm-hmm. are you seeing that you can do that quicker now and treatments quicker?
So
in the past, I think we use like equipment.
Yeah. So, right. So for the like on the ground application using the Marshmaster, yeah, that can take a few days to do 75 acres. And a helicopter or drone can do that really quickly. To be honest, a helicopter is faster than a drone, but like I said, it's less targeted. So the drone application at MLK South, I think it's 35 or 40 acres. They'll be able to do that in one day. It'll take longer than a helicopter, which can do that in half an hour, maybe. But, you know, less risk for drift and stuff like that.
And then second question, I drive by the Brookford quite a bit. You got all that old dead wood that's sitting out there. Do you just let that rot out and just leave it there?
Or like the standing trees or?
All those stuff fell over.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's sitting, and I saw the guys out there doing the flood plans. Around all the dead wood that's there.
Yeah. So for the most part, unless it's easy to pull out, which I would say 90% of the time it's not, we leave it to rot. It, you know, in part provides habitat for wildlife, but also it's just not cost effective to pull some of that stuff out. You know, in part, it can definitely be an eyesore, but definitely getting more water on the site, some of that stuff will break down.
I have a question on that same location. Historically, there were those trees that were there before it flooded out and started doing all this work, and the birds were nesting there.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any man-made structures, like I've seen in the South, they'll have like old telephone poles with platforms on it. I mean, is that something that fits into this type of a setup, or is that wishful thinking?
Yeah. So to be honest, Daniel could address that more, but yes, I mean, so...
Okay.
Okay.
I know the big push is going east because it's all wide open. It's way cooler. All the density as far as population is going west, including all the recreational things. So one of the conversations we're having with Dan is to try to move that and get all of those phragmites and all the invasive species taken care of, where all the trails are, the parks, and all of the density where people can see. As much as we like to get people to MLK South, 24 maybe are there, whereas there's tens of thousands that are over on the other side. So what are the challenges that you're going to give me on why we're not going to be pushing harder to get that taken care of?
So I think you'll be hopefully happy to hear about a new funding opportunity that we're pursuing directly adjacent to Spring Park, moving further west. It's a new 800-acre habitat restoration. Daniel's going to touch on that. It's a funding opportunity that we're pursuing. So we've been looking at the Marshalltown Marsh area, which is, you know, to the east. So that's definitely something we can continue to discuss with Dan. Right now we've gone off of what our ecologists' site assessments were, which I think, you know, are ongoing, but, you know, we started in probably 2016. So we've been going after the tracts of land that seem to have the biggest chance of survival, the least cost on the front end, and also benefit to the community. But I do hear you. And yeah, I mean, we're happy to keep looking for new projects. I think, as you know, that means more money, and it also means you have to be realistic about where you're stretching your resources. Right now, the Lake County Parks crew can only handle so much.
As far as personnel?
Yes.
Thank you. Question, would you consider like educating communities, homeowner associations, POAs, that sort of thing where they could maintain and eradicate on their own?
Yeah, so and again, Daniel will touch on this in his portion, but Audubon, they have their Wild Indigo Community Engagement Program. We've been actively, you know, I kind of am talking about all the dirty herbicide chainsaw work, but Audubon and our partnership as a whole has been pursuing that community engagement pretty actively.
Yeah, and we, you know, my name is Daniel Suarez. I'm the conservation manager with Audubon Great Lakes. And I would just say that, like, yeah, if if you had particular communities in mind. I mean, certainly we're really focusing in on the communities in and around the sites that we're already doing on the ground management. But if there are opportunities to educate HOAs or things like that, I mean, certainly we'd be interested in talking about it.
Communities that already have that base plan all over the place.
Yeah. Or maybe an opportunity to like have a larger kind of symposium where we can invite communities across the basin to come and learn about, you know, invasive species, how you can do it at home, things like that, for sure.
Gotcha.
And I'll just keep on going here. And just really quick, I just want to summarize the last three summers that we've had, because it's helpful in thinking about like where we are with on the ground conditions and, you know, overlapping with everything that Harry just said. 2021, we started seeing really low water levels, really, really severe drought. Audubon has been coordinating marsh bird monitoring across not only Northwest Indiana, but the southeast side of Chicago since 2015. And in 2021, across the sites within the Basin Commission here, so MLK South, Grant Street / Chase Street and Highland Heron Rookery, we had 361 focal bird species detections. So these are 361 individual detections of 11 species of marsh birds that we're monitoring, which when you look at those numbers, really give you an indication as to overall health of the habitat. And so we've been using that as a barometer to gauge the health of the sites and to gauge the effectiveness of the treatments that we've been doing on invasive species. In 2021, with low water, you get a lot of exposed muck like you're seeing here, which gives you a lot of opportunities for germination of native species and also, unfortunately, invasive species sometimes as well. So 2021 was a year where a lot of plants were popping up in areas that previously were had no vegetation. So we started taking advantage of that with some focused plug planting efforts, and those have grown in the couple years since. 2022, we had the start to the summer was and the spring was nice and wet, and then we gradually moved back into drought conditions. Because of that extra water early in the spring, we had a significant increase in focal species detections, almost 200 more. Sora and Virginia rail, two species of rail, which are these marsh birds, had great years across almost every single site. That number was skewed by migrants that were just passing through Northwest Indiana. They didn't necessarily stay here to breed, but these, it just underscores the importance of these sites, not only for breeding habitat but also during migration. And in 2023, we're finding ourselves, the low water levels are continuing again this year. Seems like we're moving back into drought. The fingers crossed that that can change, as was mentioned earlier. But honestly, for the purposes of installing those water control structures, having some dry conditions would actually be helpful for getting equipment in and out. We're seeing, like Harry mentioned, improving habitat quality almost across the board. With the increased opportunities for native species to germinate, like Harry said, areas that previously had been adjacent to Phragmites that we had treated are now seeing Phragmites popping up in these areas that totally dried up. As the dirt is exposed and it dries up, Phragmites likes to move into those areas. We're not terribly concerned because we know that a wet year would likely flood out a lot of that Phragmites, and we've got a pretty good handle on where the Phragmites is and isn't at the sites we're managing. So we're continuing to monitor that. As Harry mentioned again, increased plug planting opportunities. So these low water years are giving us an opportunity to really revegetate. And a lot of the marsh bird monitoring that I did in Northwest Indiana this spring, a lot of cold and windy mornings, which is not conducive to marsh bird monitoring or marsh birds actually calling out. The monitoring just finished for 2023 last Friday. So I don't have those updated numbers quite yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers were a little bit down from 2022, given those sustained low water levels. I wanted to take us over to the Marshalltown Marsh Hatcher Park Complex, where this winter the Lake County Parks crew really helped kickstart restoration efforts there by clearing some invasive brush and trees that were growing next to the paved trail that you couldn't even really see. This is also really good. I really want to thank the Gary Parks Department. Don Plo with Gary Parks came out to the site visit with us, said, you know, I could bring out a skid steer. We could try to scrape off some of the dirt on top of that paved trail and ease access. That was the really big factor for us. We wanted to allow people to walk on a trail from the parking lot all the way down to Iowa Street, which leads them down to the levee trail. And so we're just taking baby steps right now. We've cleared the trail. Contractors were out last week to do initial treatments on reed canary grass and purple loosestrife, and they'll be back again in July. But things are moving in the right direction there. And of course, I wanted to include a picture of the Lake County Parks crew leader, Emily, standing on top of one of the trees that they fell that was kind of a hazard, leaning over the trail. Just really thank Emily and Judah for all the work that they were doing there this winter. And they took advantage of that chainsaw training opportunity from the Wetlands Initiative, and it really paid off here. On Earth Day, we had a kickoff event at Hatcher Park with our special guest speaker, Representative Reagan Hatcher, who the park is named after her father, the late Mayor Richard Hatcher. And the event was really focused on having a few speakers to talk about the current situation at Hatcher Park, the current conditions, and where we want to go in the future at Hatcher Park and Marshalltown Marsh. We did a site tour. We saw a lot of really interesting plant communities, native plant communities that were still hanging on, and heard from a lot of residents that were really eager to see something happen with this park again. You can't really see them in this picture, but we spoke to a neighborhood resident who's been coming to the park almost daily for 40 years. And he's got a lot of really interesting ideas as to what worked at the park in the past and what worked in the future. And that'll be important for what I'm gonna say in a little bit in the future. And then just wanted to point out, we did get some good local coverage of that event, get people generating a lot of interest in the work that's going to be happening at Hatcher Park and Marshalltown Marsh over the next few years. So I also wanted to show you just some of the cool wildlife happenings within these sites. One of our, we're working at Audubon with a PhD student at Duke University, Leo Gaskins, who has been doing a study on urban muskrats. And muskrats may be in some circles vilified, but in marshes, they are ecosystem engineers. They are an absolutely vital species. As you can imagine, these marshes, and you can see kind of in this picture here, while it's overgrown with hybrid cattails, these marshes can be very dense. And heterogeneity or just having one structure across the whole site doesn't do a lot of good. Nature really thrives off of diversity in all aspects. In muskrats go into these areas, they mow down cattails and other vegetation and construct these huts. These huts could either be for shelter, or they could be these kind of like feeding platforms that they use. And Leo last year set up some cameras, both focusing on muskrat dens and then on some control areas that were just facing vegetation, like normal conditions in the marsh. And these photos are pretty amazing, and even more amazing when you know that the cameras take a photo randomly once every 5 minutes. And so the fact that we're getting some of these shots seem very lucky, but I think underscore really how much wildlife is really out there, much more than we can perceive, of course, because most animals are trying to avoid us. But this is a view, obviously, of a coyote here on a muskrat den. And we're finding that these coyotes, this was a really hot day. This was 95 degrees on May 10th. You know, some of these encounters here are showing that animals are not only looking for shelter, but they're exploiting the shelter of other animals for their own personal gain. So we didn't get to see exactly what that coyote pulled out, whether it was a muskrat or something else, but it's showing that these muskrat dens are having impacts on species beyond just the muskrats themselves. In the preliminary photos that Leo analyzed last year, he found that there were 976 unique wildlife observations representing several dozen species of birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians. And in the areas in the cameras that were focused on non-muskrat dens, less than 50 observations. So a very dramatic difference, 1,000 versus 50, showing that these really are magnets for wildlife and could play an important role in how we think about urban marsh restoration. This photo, Leo became very well trained in identifying species that were really not sticking out and really blending into the background here. But in this photo, there are three distinct species, and maybe some of you can spot some of them. I think two of them are pretty visible, and then the third is a little bit of a surprise. So there's three of them. All the way on the right, we have a muskrat, which is hanging out next to a sorrel. That sora, that's one of the rails that I was talking about, but you could see how well camouflaged it is. And then up in the top left corner, that's a black crown night heron. So very rare, endangered in most parts of the Calumet region, probably a migratory bird that's foraging here for the day. But really just showing, I mean, this kind of surprised us too, to see the diversity of animals found around the muskrat dens all at the same time, seemingly living peacefully side by side. So now for the exact opposite, just a bunch of words on the screen, but I wanted to talk about some of the grants that we have secured, two grants that we've secured already in 2023 and two more that we're going to be pursuing. But right now there is a lot of federal funding available for conservation efforts, more so than at any time. I know I've only been in the business for about 10 years, but everyone's telling me this is a once in a lifetime opportunity with the money that's coming out of the Infrastructure Reduction Act and I'm sorry, I'm already confusing the acronyms here, but there have been a huge influx of hundreds of millions of dollars for these federal programs. Back in 2022, Audubon applied for a feasibility study with the Great Lakes Commission for Marshalltown Marsh and Hatcher Park. That was unfortunately not successful of a proposal. But late last year, Victoria Wittig from the Urban Waters Partnership alerted us to the fact that the Indiana DNR Coastal Program was looking for project ideas that they could bring to NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which administers a lot of federal funding. And we told them we've got a really good project proposal for a feasibility study at this site. Would they consider it? And they really were pleased that we had basically already written the entire proposal. And so they endorsed the project. It got bumped up to the Coastal States Organization, which coordinates work across all the Great Lakes. And we were notified early this year that we were going to be awarded funding. Well, I shouldn't say we were awarded funding. The Coastal States Organization receives funding directly through NOAA, and they are working with a contractor, and we all formed this big project team. And what we're going to be doing is doing a 60% engineering and design process at Marshalltown Marsh over the next year or so. This is going to get us most of the way there, but not the full way there, in evaluating the potential for habitat restoration, access, public access, recreation opportunities, and also the potential remeandering of a 1.5 mile stretch of the Little Calumet River as it flows through this site. And that has a whole suite of positive implications. If we could remeander the river, right now it's currently a straight line. It's like a water pipeline, doesn't have the features of a natural river with banks that overflow gently, where you can create floodplain habitat and establish marsh. And so over the next, by the end of February 2024, we'll be at the 60% engineering and design process. We just had our first meeting last week with the engineers. They're finishing up some forms before they can hit the ground running, but we're coordinating this with NOAA, since NOAA is funding this work, and they're funding the project I'm about to talk about next. We've got the federal funders around the table interested in our projects, and they're interested in helping us see these projects through from engineering and design all the way into implementation. And it's probably cut off at the bottom, but this funding source is about $120,000that will go towards this. The next NOAA funding is that we recently received in April is the Coastal Habitat Restoration and Resilience for Underserved Communities grant. And so this grant will give us the opportunity to work closely with the engineers who are doing the other project on engineering and design. And this will allow us to do community engagement around the project. So we want to hear from residents in Marshalltown and in Greater Gary what they want to see in these projects. You know, certainly not everything may be possible, but it's important to incorporate community residents' feedback into the designs here at an early stage so that they really feel like the park is for them, right? Like, we could pump millions and millions of dollars into a restoration, but if the community isn't heard, they might not use the site as much as we intend. And so we're trying to do that through a series of surveys and workshops, and we'll be working with a consultant that we're going to hire to help facilitate some of that. We also carved out $50,000 for restoration at Hatcher Park, so that will help continue that in the meantime while we're doing these engineering design. And like I mentioned, this is putting us in the pipeline. So as we're learning, when NOAA and the Great Lakes Commission funds these projects with federal dollars, they're invested in them and they want to see the projects through to completion. So we're really excited about the possibility of this becoming a reality in the next few years. And the total award for this project was a little over $300,000. So just to summarize, we've got those two grants totaling just under $500,000 here, secured in 2023. Harry mentioned a grant that they would be applying for. So the Wetlands Initiative is going to be applying for another big national funding pot, the National Coastal Resilience Fund. This would allow us to do everything I basically talked about with engineering and design at Hatcher Park and Marshalltown Marsh would be replicated at the Chase Street Complex, which involves the Grant Street wetlands, the Spring Park, and all of those surrounding areas, both north and south of the river. It's almost 800 acres, a pretty unprecedented opportunity here for restoration. So we want to just do some engineering and design, understand what's feasible, what isn't. Anything on the ground that happens over something that large will take years and years to accomplish. But we're going to try to design it so that there are phases that could be little bites that can be taken off. You're working in particular units that might be a little bit easier to establish than saving the bigger, more ambitious parts for down the line there, but also featuring a very strong community engagement component as well. That one, that's due next week. So we're still tweaking the budget, but that should be anywhere from 250 to 400,000, to 300,000 on that proposal. And the other one, I know it's kind of cut off at the bottom here, but Harry mentioned it already, the Chi-Cal NFWF National Fish and Wildlife Foundation's Chi-Cal Rivers Fund has been a very reliable funder of our work in Northwest Indiana over the years, and we'll be putting in a proposal to help supplement the dollars that the commission grants us with some other funds to help keep that invasive species management work going. So all really exciting work. If we get all of these funds, that's almost $1 million in funding just in 1 year. And certainly the potential to continue growing that is there. We just, like Harry said, we got to keep up. I wish we knew that the feds were planning on releasing so much money, because we might have started hiring more staff a little bit faster. But we're trying to do this in a measured way and making sure that any acres that we touch, we're maintaining and not letting slip back into what they were. So I think that's my last slide, and happy to take questions.
Questions for this young man? Outstanding. Not for you yet. Thank you very much. So let us finish the presentation.
Okay.
If there's anything during public sector, you can bring up those questions. I'm sure the gentleman will be more than happy to answer those.
We'll be here till the end. Yep.
So the question again has to do with regards to the rookery and egrets. That's something that I remember just from when I was a kid, that was invasive species.
No.
That's something that's part of
Yeah, so rookeries are tricky because they're a temporary habitat. Every rookery that exists has a lifespan. What you see is at first you get the desirable species, the egrets, out there, and then over time what you see is that the cormorants move in. They're also a native species, so I don't mean to slander them, but they move in and they effectively, a lot of these rookeries form naturally with trees, and as birds build their nests and they're living up there, their poop effectively over time kills the tree, and so those trees start dying. You know, some of the trees at the rookery might have died from that, some of them might have died from flooding, but every rookery I've ever seen, at some point the cormorants take over and then kind of the egrets move on. And so that, which is really difficult because a lot of people come to value those rookeries and they're upset when they're gone. And so what I will say is that naturally at MLK South along the woodland, there is a new rookery that's kind of forming as we speak. And every year we've seen some more nests go up. And over time, you know, maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, the same thing will happen. The egrets.
South, Danny, mm-hmm. You have those that are man-made, similar
to yeah.
Mm-hmm. Project underwater. Mm-hmm. You know, why wouldn't a man-made structure that provides that nesting opportunity at least be something worth taking a sniff at?
Yeah, yeah, no. I mean, the.
We're not doing it up here.
Well, with the man-made structures, you can build it, but you can't guarantee that the egrets will come. So there's that factor. And if they do come, it's a matter of time before the cormorants take over and you're left with the same kind of situation. So it's one of those things where it's difficult because you can't predict where they're going to pop up or how long they're going to last. But certainly it's something that is a draw for the public. People like rookeries. And so, I mean, we're definitely not opposed to talking about, you know, looking at some of those options in the future, but Mother Nature will probably decide.
West, that's where all the bike trails and mm-hmm. recreational and a lot of the density.
Yeah. Yep.
It's nice to have those types of things. We'll have a little bit of, and then you can always migrate those people to, you know, MLK.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah, and like Harry said, the sites that we chose at the beginning were chosen based off of a very elaborate model that our scientists built showing areas where you could restore the most habitat. And habitat that these marsh birds, which are really good indicators of environmental health, will be at. And so some sites that are really heavily wooded or might be too small or might be right next to some other development might not be as attractive to those birds. And so marsh birds are not the only lens with which we look at these sites. So certainly we can talk about other areas for the future where there's more eyes. It's important to get people to see these restorations because that gives you your best opportunity to educate, and then, you know, and then the money comes.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you think we're just ditch people. All right, moving right along. Next up is other issues, new business.
You know, if you want to do something.
Mr. Chairman, there's a new business item A. I would make the motion that we table the Hickory Ridge Flood Control Improvement Watershed application until a future time.
There's a motion to table the application. Is there a second?
Right.
Any discussion? Be there none. Mrs. Lambert.
Yes.
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 Yes. All right, moving right along. Next up is statements to the board from the floor. Please come up to the microphone up by Mr. Repay and Mrs. Lambert if you want to address the board. Keeping in mind, too, that we're also at the campus of IUN where Tamarack Hall, which was the first building on this particular site, was lost because of the 2008 flood. If you have a story about that, that'd be cool as well. Anything to say? Okay, go up to the microphone, ma'am, by all means. State your name and address and help us.
Good evening, everyone. And we're so glad that you're here. We've been asking for the Little Cal Commission to come to Gary for a very long time. And so I think this meeting.
Yes, ma'am. What's your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Carolyn McCready, and I'm a resident of the city of Gary. But again, we're very glad to see all of you here. And I just want to say that every time I come to a Little Cal Commission meeting, I'm always very impressed with the level of the work that's being done to restore the natural beauty and the robustness of our area. And so I'm really here to talk again tonight about, you know, in light of that, this Maya project that continues to haunt us. We hear tonight that they still, you know, they were not able to come up with the money again for their lease agreement. And, you know, their whole history has been very checkered, to say the least. And it seems that from what we hear tonight, especially $250,000 being spent on restoration west of Chase Street, which is adjacent to the area where Maya would like to set up shop, is really in contradiction to what the work of what people who are interested in natural spaces are doing, and doing so well and so beautifully and with such determination. You know, it makes no sense if Maya were allowed to do what they say they want to do, and that is to bring in garbage on trucks down 35th Avenue, you know, 24/7, you know, from sunup to sundown, bail it, send it out someplace else, and then do other things. And in addition to which, create a concrete pad over acres and acres and acres of what used to be designated as a floodplain. So I think, as Chairman Baker said, and I can't remember exactly how he said it, but if we are standing there with a 5-gallon bucket, and Mother Nature comes along with 10 gallons, then what are we going to do? Well, that's what would happen, it seems to me, even with the protection of the levees. If all those acres were, you know, concreted over so that some people could make some money, you know, it would be another disaster and in contradiction to, you know, to what people want. And I know that the commission has received the resolution that this Gary City Council passed 6-9 disapproving of any further action that Maya could take to set up shop at 35th between Grant and Chase Streets. Now we have the city of Gary itself on record, you know, opposing going into court. We haven't heard what the court has decided yet, but they went in opposing IDEM, saying, sure, go ahead. Right. Okay. So we know that now the city council has taken a position, but we also know that this whole thing happened in a way that it shouldn't have happened. But let me say this. The city was bamboozled by Mr. Ventura, because when he came before before the planning commission, it was for a different address and for a recycling committee. They were going to recycle cardboard and, you know, other things that are very benign on Chase Street. Then, as the project grows, it becomes this garbage dump on acres and acres of land coming down 35th Avenue. So this is why the resolution asks for the city to rescind the ordinance that allowed for this thing to start. So we're hoping that the commission understands that with the amazing work that you are doing in restoration in the city of Gary, and particularly at that location, that would stand an absolute contradiction to that work if you were to continue this contract that you have with these people called Maya. So I think that all of this is coming into much much more obvious understanding, much more obvious relief, so that you can really see who these people are, and that they are, and that what they want to do in the city of Gary stands in absolute contradiction to what this commission, what you fund, and what your mission is. So I'm hoping that everything will turn out well. I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but I think the commission really needs to understand this differently now. And I'm pretty sure that many of you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
So my name is Doreen Carey. I live at 7304 Indian Boundary in Gary, Indiana. I just want to reiterate some of the things that Ms. McCrady has stated. And this is in regard to the Maya Energy LLC business, or lack of business. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Chairman Baker stated that the role of the commission is flood control, environmental restoration, and recreation. I believe that's what you stated. Is that correct?
It's flood control and recreation.
Flood control and recreation.
And recreation, in my opinion, includes having nice things to look at, and also includes the money associated with doing all those cool things.
Right. So we could call that environmental restoration and environmental protection, I think.
You have a microphone, Doreen, however you want to phrase it.
I will. Thank you. And so I would suggest that your role is improving the environment, not contributing to degradation and pollution with a business like My Energy LLC. Gary is an environmental justice community overburdened by current and legacy pollution. And the only way we're going to get over that is by not adding more pollution and controlling, better controlling and ratcheting down the pollution that we have. I'm just going to state the remarks that EPA made. If I can just turn the page here. That EPA made in their comments to the IDEM permit renewal when they were allowing comments on their permit renewal. And they determined that the proposed location of the facility raises potential environmental justice concerns. Data from EPA's environmental justice screening tool illustrates the severity of pollution and health impacts facing the community living in proximity to the Maya Energy LLC site. The neighborhoods around the proposed facility have some of the highest levels in the state for many environmental justice indexes reported by the EPA EJ screen. And EJ screen is a useful first step in understanding communities that may have environmental justice concerns. The values for 10 of the 12 environmental justice indexes for the tracts of Black Oak and Glen Park neighborhoods around which the facility is sited exceed the 80th percentile in the state. This includes indexes for particulate matter less than 2.5 microns in diameter, ozone, diesel particulate matter, air toxics, cancer risk, air toxics, respiratory hazard, traffic proximity,
understood, Maureen. It's a lot of stuff.
Almost. Lead and Superfund site proximity. The population living in the area around the proposed site is significantly comprised of people of color, those with low income, those with less than high school education, and a high unemployment rate. Furthermore, the facility is sited across the street from Still City Academy and the K-12 school. In addition, it is adjacent to the Chase Street Spring Park. And I would just like to say one more thing with regard to EPA's comments.
Because of the environmental conditions already facing this community and the potential for additional disproportionate and adverse impact based on race, national origin, or other protected class, the siting of this facility, that is to say Maya Energy LLC, may raise civil rights concerns. So it is important that we all think about the impact that some of these decisions that are being made can have, not just on an individual piece of property, which in this case I think is very important because of its connection to the big projects that are going on here, the Wetlands Initiative, the Calumet Collaborative. It is right in the middle of all that work that you're doing, and it does raise environmental justice concerns and civil rights concerns when we think about how we are treating the development of our city. We need to be sustainable, we need to look to the future, and we need to go in the direction that you're already going with the projects that we received presentations on tonight. So thank you again. We'd like you to really consider rescinding that lease agreement with Maya Energy LLC. And I'm sure that you have the lawyers and the know-how to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Anybody else like to speak? Yes, sir.
Hi, Gary Lee from Gary. I just want to lend my voice to support of the two previous speakers. I think what we're kind of looking for is some positive message from the commissioners. Hey, we don't agree with my energy as well. We don't hear that from anybody. You know, I personally would like to hear a resolution passed by this commission that you'll do everything in your power to do away with my energy. We're looking for support for you from as the community desires. And to Mr. Baker's comment about spending money for conservation efforts west of Klein Avenue, I would take a different approach. And what I would do would be expedite the overpasses from west to east to where all the people from west could get on that bike path and go all the way over to Marshalltown. They would be able to see all the work.
That's the goal, Gary. You've been here for a while. That's the goal.
Well, I'm saying expedite it. You say that's the goal. I
think we're doing pretty good, sir, but go ahead.
Well, I might take exception with that because,
of course,
you can put an interstate through in 10 years and you've got one overpass done. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's one overpass over one street. When you bid Kennedy Avenue, why don't you bid three or four different streets at the same time? Because if I'm not mistaken, you're going to bid Kennedy Avenue this year, correct? So why not bid Klein? Why not bid Grant? Why not bid Broadway? All at the same time. With the project.
Duly noted.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to help us? All right, going once, going twice. We're on the road again next month for the meeting, which is on the 19th of July. We'll be at the Indiana Welcome Center, which everybody hopefully knows is off of Kennedy Avenue and the Borman on in Hammond. Check the website for that. Let's go down the list, Mr. Castellanos.
Well, I would like to compliment all the speakers for their opinions. Believe me, it's well noted, we understand, and we're taking it into consideration. But don't forget that we're not taking it into consideration. Also, I'd like to compliment the two gentlemen, Juarez and Mr. Kuttner, did I say it right? Excellent. I personally like to see you do something for Spring Park. I had no idea that there's so much going on with the plantations. Thank you for the education. Appreciate that very much. Second, I would like to say I want to thank our committee here because Gary and Griffith starting to work together and working together on that low mark application that's going to improve our community. There's been some ruffles between the past, between us and the city, but now we're starting to work together. So I'm going to say I want to compliment Tom Wyslinski. Looking forward to working with you, Tom, on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ochi.
I just want to add to what David indicated. Thank you, Northwest Indiana, for giving the accommodations here. Thank you for all the speakers and presenters that came out tonight. Really educational one. It's got to be where we are, where we go. Kind of going to hold us the field of the planning of how the commission can be
assistant to that,
which I comment sections. I think the commission and myself understand your comments and we take them with the utmost urgency. And thank you for that. They're passionate comments and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Nemitz.
I'd like to thank Spencer and Harry and Danielle for the presentations tonight. I was happy to see your successes. I hope that you're proud of the work that you're doing because from what I see, you're doing great work. Thank you.
Mr. Gazdecki.
I would echo the commissioners to my left, all their comments, and thank you for attending, everybody.
Mr. Wyslinski.
Great presentation tonight. A lot of good information. Thank all the people that came out tonight and voiced their concerns, and we'll see everybody next month. Thank you.
Mr. Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly want to thank Dan and Jody for putting us on the road. Makes it seem like it's a lot more intimate with, you know, the community and to be able to have the IUN as a host and someone who's knowledgeable about wetland initiatives. So Dr. Spencer, thanks a lot. Very informative. I've continued to support opposition to Meyer Energy Project from day one. And my support and opposition of it has not wavered. So I do want to express that publicly, continue to express that publicly. I am hopeful that we're able to do a better job with our minority participation. I have been able to talk to Dan in the event that there's a need or just bring others to his attention of different types of services. And then there's the other side of what we don't know in terms of what service is needed. You know, we probably need to do a better job just communicating that with each other, what service may be needed and, you know, express that to us as a commission rather than just us express, you know, that there's a vendor that can provide a service. So I do hope that we can follow up relatively soon on the various services that we may need or that we may anticipate and that we can have more engagement. We spend quite a few dollars. You see, we spent $1 million tonight. Bulk of it's for one project, but we spend a lot of money, and with a lot of our money going to our watershed applications. I can't personally say how towns are spending that money, but you would hope that they are doing their due diligence and including minority contractors in their process as well. You know, we certainly say that that's something that we would like to see them do. But once we write a check, you know, to them, you know, we trust that they would follow that. But we would have to do a better job of being stewards of our own domain here first. So I hope that we continue to make that a priority, a top priority, as a matter of fact. And if we do care about how to enhance the Lake County community and not have as evident of a divide as it looks. So those are my sentiments, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ware.
I just want to thank those in attendance this evening. Thank you for the comments that were made. The presentation's outstanding, very informative to see what's going on in and around the watershed. Thank you to IUN for hosting and Gary for hosting. It is good to get out and about in the communities that we're all in. And I want to wish everyone a happy and safe fourth weekend and upcoming. Thank you.
Mr. Wicklund.
Nothing to add.
Nothing to add. Mrs. Lambert. You're going to really freak me out when you say yes one of these times. All right. Like I said, next meeting is third Wednesday, which is July 19th. It'll be at the Indiana Welcome Center. Entertaining a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Is there a second? And a second. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, everybody.